Welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us at this Free the Truth event in defense of Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks publisher. As many of you know, Julian is still in Belmarsh prison, a maximum security prison, and as a journalist, awaiting extradition to the United States. There are a number of aspects of Julian's case that are really disturbing and really worrying. His case sets an important precedent for both free speech and the freedom of journalists, but also for issues such as state collusion in the persecution of an individual, arbitrary detention, torture, human rights. And our Free the Truth events have tried to showcase all those different aspects of Julian's case. These events started last year in the run-up to Julian's trial to encourage a public debate about the issues surfaced by the case. My name is Deepa Govindarajan Driver. I'm a university lecturer and trade unionist working at the University of Reading. And together with my colleague, Professor Ian Munro, who's at the University of Newcastle and specializes in a number of things, including whistleblowing, we are trying to help change the narrative, understand the truth about Julian, and which is why this series of events is called Free the Truth. In the past, we've had some illustrious speakers, including Professor Niels Melzer, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, John Pilger, the noted journalist, Lisa Longstaff from Women Against Rape, Eva Jolie, Fidel Narvaez, so many big names who've all come together to make the point that the persecution of Julian Assange is about more than just Julian Assange. It's also about how our civil liberties, how our rights, how our futures are being undermined by rogue states. So I'm very happy to welcome you to this event today. Well, happy in a sense that we have such an august panel, but not so happy given the circumstances that we're convening this event. I'd like to introduce, first of all, the three speakers. We have Professor Mats Andenas, who is professor at the University of Oslo, an honorary QC, and also at the Institute of Advanced Legal Studies, and widely published. He was a former member of the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention and a UN Special Rapporteur on Arbitrary Detention. So welcome, Mats. Thank you for joining us today. We also have on the panel Ben Wisner. Ben is at the ACLU. He specializes in he's the director of the ACLU's Technology, Speech and Privacy Project. He specializes in understanding the intersection between civil liberties and national security. He's looked at things ranging from airport security through to watch lists, surveillance practices, targeted killing, and torture. So he's litigated on numerous cases in the area that is relevant to today's discussion. And last but not least, we have Robert Thibault, who's well known for helping Edward Snowden through Hong Kong. But Robert is a litigating barrister. He works on both administrative law and constitutional law. He's had an illustrious background of over 30 years in these areas, and he will talk to us a little bit about those nuances of the case. I'd like to thank Don't Extradite Assange, who are hosting this event and broadcasting this event through their channel, and people like Somerset Bean, who provides the graphics, Catherine Brown, who's done our transcripts, and the Committee to Defend Julian Assange, who have helped with many of the organizational aspects of the Free the Truth events. So at this stage, and without further ado, I'd like to hand over to Robert Thibault to tell us a little bit about his thoughts on the case. Over to you, Robert. You're still muted, Robert.
Yeah. Thank you, Deepa. Thank you for having me here today. Now, Deepa has asked me to explain very briefly the key aspects of an extradition hearing, extradition law. So I'm going to go through that right now. And I'm going to make reference to the particulars of Mr. Assange's case and the process that he's gone through up to this point and what we would expect to see over the next year. In terms of extradition law, extradition is founded on a treaty that would exist between two countries, both countries agreeing that, you know, this is the foundation for seeking the extradition of an alleged fugitive or fugitive from the one jurisdiction to the counterpart's jurisdiction. Now, in most countries around the world, where between two countries where there is a treaty, in each jurisdiction, there'll be domestic legislation that provides the legal framework for extradition and provisions on how, what the process is and how it would operate. Okay. Now, between the US and the UK, there is a treaty between the two countries. And in the UK, there is the Extradition Act. The Extradition Act was updated in 2003, and there's been some amendments to that since then. And in Mr. Assange's case, a little over a year ago, he was taken into custody forcefully by the British authorities who entered the Ecuadorian embassy. And I point out that, and I've said this publicly before, that Mr. Assange's due process rights within Ecuador were violated in the Ecuadorian government allowing that to happen. Now, at that point, the U.S. government, under the treaty, makes a formal request to the UK government for Mr. Assange's arrest and extradition. So my understanding is that a warrant was issued for Mr. Assange's arrest when he was in custody of the British police, the British authorities. And once he was arrested, then he was brought before a committal court or a magistrate's court before a magistrate to commence extradition proceedings. Now, this process involves the U.S. government necessarily providing the charges or in the indictments against Mr. Assange, and these have to be clearly identified and particularized. And so the U.S. government has done that. They did that last year. And at that point, the extradition process commences with the U.S. government being represented by the UK prosecutors, providing disclosure, providing documents and evidence to Mr. Assange. So over the last year, up until even now, there's been disclosure, or there's ongoing disclosure from the U.S. government to Mr. Assange's defense team. Okay. And the extradition court's role, and this needs to be made very clear, is not to judge Mr. Assange on whether he's guilty or not guilty. The extradition court's role is simply to make a decision on whether there is sufficient evidence to proceed to criminal prosecution of Mr. Assange. And this is typical in any criminal case in any domestic jurisdiction. The court, an application may be made by defense counsel submitting that there's not sufficient evidence to proceed. Okay. So the interesting part about the extradition judge's role is that the standard of proof is not at a criminal standard, it's at a civil standard. It's a lower standard. So the extradition judge has to decide whether there's a prima facie case, whether there's sufficient enough evidence to proceed. So it's a relatively low standard. Okay. That process is an evidential hearing. And I understand that evidential hearing hasn't taken place yet. And I understand that it's fixed for about 3 weeks. And I've read that on May 4th, the court will fix dates for that. And I understand that would be later this year. Now, as part of the process that's been ongoing, there's a number of things that have been happening, a number of applications before this evidential hearing. One has been bail, and Mr. Assange has been denied that. The other is adjournment. The defense and Mr. Assange has certain due process rights, constitutional rights, and that is he should be afforded reasonable time to prepare, reasonable access to his lawyers, to be able to communicate with his lawyers, to obtain legal advice, and also to receive documents and communicate with his lawyers, to have that reasonable access. That has been an enormous area of contention. And from my observations, it appears that Mr. Assange's due process rights, it appears they've been fettered and obstructed. And from what I've read and what I've spoken with people about what's been happening in the court, it appears that Mr. Assange has had great difficulty having access to his lawyers and having legal advice and being able to prepare, and his legal team being able to prepare. There are other applications or submissions that are being made prior to the evidential hearing. One is on dual criminality. In order for the U.S. to succeed, they have to prove that the offenses that they've indicted Mr. Assange with in the U.S., that there are equivalent offenses in the UK. And that's an issue that will be decided by the magistrate. The other issue is applications by the defense to have the case stayed or have the case dismissed. And the core application that I've seen that's been made by Mr. Fitzgerald, QC, is the exclusion, an exception to extradition based on political offenses. And I'll just briefly mention that in the US-UK treaty, there's a provision under Article 4.2 that there shall be no extradition if the indictments from the US amount to political offenses. And very quickly, political offenses fall into two categories. The first are pure political offenses. And these are offenses that are not common crimes, but are crimes alleged to target the head of state or the government or a branch of government with a view to, and in Mr. Assange's case, with a view to change policy. Okay. And it's very clear from the treaty that the offenses, the indictments of Mr. Assange fall under these pure political offenses, except possibly one. There's a computer-related offense. That offense is what they call a relative political offense, meaning it's categorized as a common crime, but the purpose and motivation of that crime being committed or alleged to be committed by Mr. Assange, the purpose and motivation was to change government policy. So I understand that Mr. Fitzgerald is arguing that the court should not make an order to have Mr. Assange surrendered and extradited to the U.S. because these offenses are all political offenses. The prosecution is arguing that the treaty provisions do not apply. And these provisions do not apply because they're not in the Extradition Act. But there are unique aspects to the treaty and the UK Extradition Act, and that is clearly the treaty is part of the Extradition Act. It's referred to. And secondly, it's been ratified by the UK government. And there's no provision in the Extradition Act excluding the political offense provision. So this is an important issue that's going to be decided by the magistrate. Mr. Fitzgerald, on behalf of Mr. Assange, is also arguing that the U.S. in having this provision in the treaty for political offenses is actually abusing the court process in the U.K. By seeking to have Mr. Assange extradited, while and asking that the political offense provision be ignored, even though it's in their own treaty. So, what we would expect to see over this next, I guess, the latter part of this year, would be for these applications to be decided. Now, Mr. Assange has a number of defenses that will be available to him at the evidential hearing, and those defenses are incorporated into the UK Extradition Act. One of them is whether there is an infringement or violation of Mr. Assange's, or there will be a violation of Mr. Assange's constitutional rights. And so that's when the fundamental rights and freedoms aspect comes into Mr. Assange's case. And for example, if he is sent to the United States, will he be ill-treated? Will he be subjected to cruel and inhuman degrading treatment or punishment? Will he be tortured? And I would expect that these submissions will be made in due course. And foundation for that application would be the treatment of Chelsea Manning. There's another aspect in terms of the judges to considering whether to extradite Mr. Assange or not, is disproportionality or proportionality. And the court has to take into account Mr. Assange's health, as well as whether Mr. Assange, whether his sentence is disproportionate. And I understand 170 years is a possible sentence for Mr. Assange. So the court will have to consider whether to grant the extradition request and make that order or not. So with that, that's a general understanding of what's going on and what we would expect to see within Mr. Assange's case.
Thank you, Robert. That's really helpful, because for many of us, we understand what's going on more broadly in the world, particularly those of us who are supporters who are following the developments in the case, but we don't really understand how the process of the court unfolds. So it's really helpful to put those things in context. And I can see already a number of questions are coming in through the YouTube chat and also through the Q&A panel. There are a couple of questions and comments, which I think the other speakers will be picking up as well. So just if you could keep your questions going through the Q&A window at the bottom of the screen, please. Or if you're hearing this on YouTube or Twitter, please pass your questions through to us and we will try and have as many of them answered as possible. And thank you, Robert, for that very helpful lesson in understanding the basics of the legal aspects of the case. That's really helpful. I'd now like to invite Professor Mart Sandanas. Mart's given his background in arbitrary detention, working in the UN Working Group, and of course his illustrious academic career, will shed some light on some of the issues around the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment that Julian has been subjected to. I've also asked a few questions to Mart beforehand, so hopefully Mart will deal with some of those through his presentation. Over to you, Mart.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure you'll get back to those questions if I overlook or forget one or two of them. So the starting point here is, of course, that there are some people with power in the state who regard Julian Assange as somebody who has offended vital interests of the state, and then are using all the powers of the state and attempting to do so within a legal framework. And these people are, of course, mainly in the United States of America, but also in the United Kingdom, and collaborating with the forces then within the UN, within the US government system. And of course, previously, we also had such collaboration from the people in the Swedish, among the Swedish authorities. And, well, the cases are quite, they are complicated. There are really three rounds. The first is the Swedish government or a Swedish prosecutor requesting Assange's extradition to Sweden to stand trial, to be investigated, and possibly stand trial for different sexual offences. There are many issues there, but that's the case which went through the English courts and then ended up in the UK Supreme Court. And that's then after that decision that he then gets bail, and he then goes to the Latin American embassy. And when they break into the embassy, or with collaboration from the embassy, then apprehend him in the embassy last year, he is then prosecuted for breach of his bail conditions, and he's getting a disproportionate sentence for that breach of these bail conditions. And the UK process, which ended up in the Supreme Court, was there a sufficient extradition request from the Swedish prosecutor for the UK authorities to be able then to extradite, hand him over to the Swedish authorities. And, well, the UK courts disagreed. You know, there were judges in the US, there were judges in the UK Supreme Court who dissented when they made their final determination of the legality of this extradition request. You had two of the judges, the president, Lady Hale, who just retired, and the judge who soon afterwards became her vice president of the Supreme Court, Lord Matz. They held that the extradition request did not comply with the requirements of UK legislation and the European arrest warrant. It's interesting because when you talk to lawyers about that, people who haven't really read up, they say it's a clear case. His the legal issues were clear. They weren't. There was also a process going on before the Swedish courts, and it ended up on one point in the Swedish Supreme Court, and that was the question of could the Swedish prosecutor maintain the extradition request? And a reporting judge to the Swedish Supreme Court, she said, no, this is disproportionate under all circumstances. And the majority of the Supreme Court then did not agree with her, but one of the judges did, and gave a very clear reasoning for his point of view, which was that the extradition request could not be maintained. And then the Swedish prosecutor then went to a first instance court and asked for a new pretrial detention order, which was necessary then to maintain the extradition request. And the Swedish prosecutor didn't get that. And the judge was very scathing, very clear, saying that the prosecution had not made out its case and under all circumstances to maintain this investigation, as it would be in the Swedish system, was disproportionate, at least in the context of the court granting a new pretrial detention order, which then again could be the basis for the extradition request. So that case fell. And then, of course, you have the US request, which then Robert Tibber has explained how then is going through the English and then will end up probably in the Supreme Court as the previous Swedish request did. And then if you move from what happened at a national level, which is quite confused, quite messed up, and in no way looking good if you look at it from the outside. So say you now were a European body, or you were the United Nations. So that's where I get in. I look at this. I'm not on the working group when it makes its ruling in, well, late 2015. But they are looking at the UK process and they say, this man was taken into isolation in a high security prison, which he was in 2010. This is disproportionate. said the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which is, of course, the UN specialist body on arbitrary detention, which is appointed by the UN Human Rights Council, where the UK was a member at a time. And by the way, the UK has never protested in the Human Rights Council or any UN context against the ruling by this UN working group, and for good reason, of course. Although there has been many people who have criticized government ministers in the UK, and I'm afraid also some independent academics and commentators, and basically doing the government's work in a way which I find quite inappropriate in some of these instances, because the UN Working Group had a very solid legal basis for its review. Now, you could say, if you go through these local processes, so local, I mean, UK ending up in the Supreme Court, Sweden ending up in the Supreme Court, well, then it's all right. Fact of the matter, it's not, because we have this international system. We have the European Convention on Human Rights. We have the different UN instruments, in particular the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They are there because states cannot be trusted. If there's a strong enough state interest, states will sometimes fail. They will fail now and then. And that's why you have this international supervisory system. And that's when UK then, when these decisions and the procedures were reviewed, the UN Working Group held that this constituted an arbitrary detention. And what constituted an arbitrary detention? Well, first of all, putting him into this high security detention, which he was released from after quite a short while, a couple of weeks. And then the UN Working Group said, Mr. Assange was then, he would quite certainly be apprehended again and taken into custody by the UK authorities. So when he walked into this embassy, which he did from the street, after some previous arrangement, I'm sure, then how could this constitute a detention, has been the argument by some of the commentators. And this is in fact a house arrest. How could the working group come to that? Well, it looked at some other cases. It had made rulings before based on rulings International Court for Reform of Yugoslavia, and its own rulings. And its own ruling, one of its own rulings, concerned the wife of the Chinese Nobel Prize laureate. She lived in a flat. She was not in prison. She lived in that flat. Whenever she walked out into the street, there would be men in uniform who would stand around her, and she was compelled to walk back to the flat. She felt compelled to walk back to the flat. Her telephone line was disconnected. Friends gave her mobile phones, which at the time, because the authorities were not as efficient as they are today, may have worked for some minutes or half an hour. And this was, in effect, a house arrest. House arrest, which constituted detention, and it was arbitrary. And that's the background. That's how the working group argued. And of course, we now know what happens to Julian Assange. When he is apprehended by the UK authorities, he's then again taken into this kind of disproportionate high security detention in a prison where he, and under circumstances which he should not have been detained. In itself, that constitutes arbitrary detention. The working group on arbitrary detention has later looked at his treatment. They also looked at the conviction he got for having broken his bail conditions. And they held that, under all circumstances, to convict him for breach of these bail conditions would again constitute a breach of the prohibition against arbitrary detention. Now, the special rapporteur, Nils Melzer, the special rapporteur on torture, and a number of the other rapporteurs have also criticized and held the UK authorities in breach of international human rights obligations. And I think that the important, or perhaps the most important point here, is that whenever a national authority, whether it's a court or a prosecution authority, whomever it is, when they make decisions about detention, and particularly when it involves freedom of expression rights, right of information, rights of journalists, they have to have a particular anxious review. Because these are cases where, traditionally, the way courts often operate, where they give way to strong state interests, they would not take care of, they would not give sufficient weight to the rights of the individuals rights they have, not only in the narrow detention context, but in a wider freedom of expression context. And that is important for the UK authorities. It's not a question only of constitutional rights coming in through the extradition legislation. They have a duty to maintain, to defend his right against arbitrary detention, against torture, and they're also a duty to set the bar particularly high in his individual case, because freedom of expression is involved. And if they don't do so, they commit basic mistakes, which will mean that international bodies, the European Human Rights Court, the different UN bodies involved here, again will hold that process against Assange is in violation, is in breach of fundamental human rights. Deepa, did that cover the questions you had for me?
Thank you, Mads. Hopefully I'm unmuted now while I'm speaking. Thank you for that helpful contextual explanation. I will come back to you with some questions for both Robert and you, but over now to Ben Wiesner. So far we have looked at what's already happened and the past and the human rights context and also the constitutional context and the process as we see it unfold here in Britain. But one very important thing that is at the back of Julian's mind and at the back of the minds of his lawyers is the treatment that Julian could potentially receive in the US. And in addition to all the due process rights that have been violated for Julian, and in addition to all the surveillance of his privileged conversations with his lawyers and those kinds of breaches, it is also very interesting for us, interesting and depressing for us to think about what would happen if the rule of law was undermined and he was actually extradited to the US. And to help us understand the US context of this and to understand how the process would work in the US and tell us a little bit also about the special administrative measures that Julian is likely to, and his lawyers are likely to be under in the US, is Ben Wiesner from the ACLU. Ben, over to you.
Thank you, Deepa, for inviting me. Good morning, or rather, good afternoon to many of you. Good morning here in New York. And thank you, Mats and Robert, for that very helpful framing of some of the legal issues here. My remarks will be fairly brief. I see there are a bunch of questions already, and I'm more interested in answering questions that you might have than giving you a long lecture. But I want to speak for a moment about why the Assange case is considered by many to be the most dangerous case for press freedom in the modern history of the United States. This is the first time in our modern history that anyone has been criminally charged by the United States government for publishing truthful information that was lawfully acquired. And we'll come back to that. But first, a little bit of background. As you've heard already, Julian Assange has been charged under the Espionage Act of 1917. This was a law that was enacted during World War I, principally to crush dissent and to punish conscientious objectors to that war, to slightly oversimplify, but not much, this law makes it a crime to disclose what's called national defense information to anyone who is not authorized to receive it. And as you can see, this is an extremely broad law. We don't have an Official Secrets Act in the United States, but on the language of this law, it can be used that way. On its face, it criminalizes all leaks of sensitive government information, and there is no express exemption in this law for journalism. Journalists also can disclose or disseminate national information to people who are not authorized to receive it. The law makes no distinction between sharing information with journalists or by journalists in the public interest and selling that information to foreign enemies for personal profit. It's exactly the same crime. Now, for most of its history, the Espionage Act was not used to punish leakers to the press, and it has never before now been used to target a journalist. And I think people forget this because we've seen so many prosecutions over the last 15 years under the Espionage Act for leaks to the press. But as late as the 1970s, the top lawyer for the CIA testified in Congress that he was not certain whether the Espionage Act even applied to leaks to the press. But if it did, there had been an unprecedented crime wave in Washington going back decades, because surely there had been tens of thousands of leaks to the press by high and low government officials that violated the terms of the Espionage Act. And it was not until 1984 that we saw the first conviction under the Espionage Act for a leak to the press. Someone in the Navy was convicted of disclosing a photo to a publication called Jane's Defense Weekly. Now, as I mentioned, in recent years, it's much more common to see leaks to the press prosecuted under the Espionage Act, including, of course, Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden, whom Robert and I have represented, both facing charges under the Espionage Act. And it's important to emphasize that under the Espionage Act, these charges are essentially strict liability offenses. There is no defense of public interest. If Edward Snowden were brought into a United States courtroom to face trial, he would not be able to introduce as a defense that these disclosures led to reforms of the law in the United States, that Congress changed our surveillance laws to narrow them for the first time since the 1970s, that courts held some of these programs illegal. None of that would be relevant or admissible in a prosecution under the Espionage Act. And this is why, of course, Edward Snowden went to the airport and not to a lawyer's office after disclosing some of this information. Now, here's why the Espionage Act, under which Julian Assange is charged, is so dangerous for a democracy. Let's just think in the US context of what the United States classified at the highest level, top secret classification in the last two decades in which I've been practicing law. It was a top national security secret that U.S. military police officers tortured and sexually humiliated defenseless prisoners in Abu Ghraib. It was an even more classified secret that the U.S. established and operated a network of secret prisons around the world and kidnapped foreign citizens, shackled them, and brought them to those places where they were interrogated without any kind of legal restraint. It is a top secret that the CIA operates a targeted killing program of terrorist suspects abroad. And certainly it was classified at the highest level that the U.S. had developed and deployed a global system of mass surveillance without the knowledge or consent of our public. Now, all of these things were disclosed through the press to the public. Every one of those disclosures was a serious felony, without any defense under the law if those cases were brought into a court. But even with this trend of more aggressively targeting leakers for disclosing information in the public interest, it has still generally been understood that charging journalists or publishers would be an even more radical step. And as I said before, even though the text of the law has no exemption for journalists, by tradition, it has been understood that would be crossing a certain kind of Rubicon, that freedom of the press would be very, very seriously challenged if the government ever brought charges against a journalist. And this is why the Obama administration, which certainly had no love for Julian Assange and had opened a criminal grand jury to explore whether there might be charges that it could bring against him, ultimately decided that it could not bring these charges in good faith. And that was because they realized that there was no principled way to distinguish between what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks did and what the Washington Post, the New York Times, and other more mainstream organs of investigative journalism do on a daily basis. And that is essentially compete with the government for control over secret information and then decide against the government's wishes to publish that information. Now, in the Assange case, the Justice Department has attempted to portray that as a criminal conspiracy, that Assange conspired with Chelsea Manning in order to violate our secrecy laws. But if you think about it, isn't all investigative journalism in the national security realm a kind of criminal conspiracy? Doesn't every investigative journalism try to find sources in government and try to persuade them to violate their laws and their obligations in order to share that information in the public interest? This is certainly what legendary investigative journalists like Seymour Hersh, like Bart Gellman, and others do. They develop sources over the years. They cajole them and persuade them to disclose information at great risk to those sources. And then they publish it even though the government considers that the leaking of that to be a serious felony. So it turns out to be quite difficult to find a way that is principled to distinguish this, what WikiLeaks is alleged to have done and what other journalists do on a daily basis. And this is why in the US, so many journalists and news organizations that are quite hostile to Julian Assange personally have been alarmed by these Espionage Act charges against him because they understand the threat to themselves. Does anyone seriously think that the Trump administration would not use a precedent established in an Assange prosecution to target other news organizations that it is hostile to? I think the question answers itself. So those are the nature of the charges that Assange would face. And it's true that he could be charged for a separate felony for every classified document that WikiLeaks published. So the amount of criminal exposure that he might face is really essentially limitless, but certainly enough to keep him in prison until he dies. Deepa asked me also to say a few words about the conditions in which he would be likely to be held. This is not totally unique to him. I think the U.S. prison practices are considered barbaric and inhumane by much of the world, in particular how much we rely on isolation and solitary confinement, which in the Manning case was part of the UN's determination that those conditions were torture. I don't think there's any doubt that Julian Assange would be held in isolation. The U.S. intelligence agency has dubbed him a foreign hostile intelligence agent. I think it's very likely that he would be held under what are called special administrative measures. And these are conditions of confinement that were developed to hold certain terrorism detainees. And the fear that the US government had was that they would use the contact they had with the outside world through their lawyers to send instructions to their followers to carry out attacks. And so their communications with the world are highly restricted and highly monitored. They're not able to get news, except in some cases, maybe a month later. Even their communications with their lawyers can be surveilled to make sure that they're not using those communications as a means of, you know, sending out harmful instructions to the world. And again, given the rhetoric that we've seen, you know, time and again from senior U.S. officials about the Assange case, I don't think there's any serious doubt that there would be an effort to put him into one of these communications management units, to put him under special administrative measures, to hold him in as much isolation as possible. And all of those, I think those conditions should be considered by the UK court in making its determination. So obviously it is the hope, not just of US human rights lawyers, but of the whole journalism community in the United States, that this case never leaves the United Kingdom, that the UK court recognizes the political nature of this offense and does not establish the principle that a journalist can be extradited. I want to make one more point about what's so extraordinary about this legal case. And that is the arrogance of the United States to suggest that a foreign journalist should be bound by the US's own criminal secrecy laws. By what right should the US be able to say that an Australian publisher violates the law by disclosing American secrets? In the last several months alone, we've seen the New York Times run lengthy investigative reports in which it published top secret documents from both China and Iran. And these were very, very admirable pieces of investigative journalism. The world needed to see these documents. But you can be quite certain, without being an expert in either Chinese law or Iranian law, that the publication of these documents was a crime in those two societies. And what would be the response of the United States if China and Iran said, we need to extradite the journalists and the publishers for their violation of our Espionage Act? We would cry foul, and we would say that is a threat to global press freedom. And I think this is an aspect of the Assange case that hasn't been sufficiently explored. And this is the notion that one state can essentially enforce its own domestic secrecy regime with severe criminal penalties on journalists and publishers who are in other countries. And with that, I will stop for now, and I look forward to questions from Deepa and the other participants.
Thank you very much, Ben. That's really given us a rounded picture of what has happened and what could happen. I'm going to move on to the questions now and just give you literally 30 seconds for our three speakers who have been focusing on each other's presentations to look at the Q&A tab at the bottom of your screen and to also allow all the readers in the audience to have a quick look at the questions. And then I'm going to start posing them live to you. Thank you very much to all those of you who have offered us questions. We're just quickly looking through them, and we're trying to make sure we answer as many as possible.
Do you want to try starting with this question and the one from Alina, which is connected? So hers was about suing. So it's about holding powerful people accountable.
No, I don't want to. Okay. I just want to quickly... Can I start then with a quick question just on the basics to Robert Thibault? Robert, would you be able to tell us something about what we see? One of the things that many of us don't understand, especially as grassroots supporters who are not steeped in the law, could you tell us about this idea of non-derogable rights that you were telling me about the other day and how they apply in Julian's case particularly? Robert? You're muted, Robert, if you could unmute yourself.
My apologies. For Julian's case, in the Extradition Act, the judge, if the issue is raised, must assess or determine whether any constitutional rights have been or will be violated if Mr. Assange is extradited to the U.S. And it's quite clear to me that if he's sent to the U.S., he will be put into conditions that amount to cruel and inhumane, degrading treatment and punishment. And also torture. Now, the court will have to look at Mr. Assange's personal physical characteristics. And clearly, he's quite fragile. He's had many health issues. And the treatment that Ben has talked about, certainly Mr. Assange will be ill-treated and it would amount to a torture. It may even risk death. Mr. Assange may not live very long under those conditions. These are all non-derogable rights, meaning Mr. Assange has a right not to be ill-treated, not to be tortured, and he has a right to life protection, that he should not be put under circumstances where he's likely to die. Okay, that means a person cannot be tortured even for 5 seconds or 1 second. They cannot be ill-treated for 1 second or 5 seconds. There's no exception to this. So in Mr. Assange's case, I would expect that his defense will raise these issues, and they will point to the prison conditions, likely have an expert provide testimony on this. And they're going to look at the Chelsea Manning case and other cases on how people held in remand or prisoners are treated. So I would expect this will be one of the core defenses that Mr. Assange will put forward. The other issue is the proportionality, and that's another provision. Once these applications are made to the magistrate must make a decision. And if there are any anticipated constitutional right violations, if sent to the U.S., then the magistrate must deny the extradition request.
Can I just add to that, that there are three grounds here. There's of course, torture, as you mentioned, ill treatment, torture, etc., Article 3 under the European Convention. Then you have Article 5 under the European Convention, the prohibition against arbitrary detention. And then you have freedom of expression, Article 10. And then under all of these provisions, you end up with something which is similar, although there's no proportionality review under torture because torture or ill treatment is prohibited. When you're discussing whether something amounts to torture or ill treatment, you have to look at the facts, and you have to look at, is this absolutely necessary in order to achieve a legitimate aim? Otherwise, you are more easily falling within the prohibition on torture or and ill treatment. And the same thing applies to detention. And of course, freedom of expression is typically the proportionality provision where you are looking at other countervailing interests, and you're trying to see, is this intervention into freedom of expression necessary, and is it proportionate? And that's something the judges at all instances should take account of. And if you are looking at the other cases before the UK courts, you know, this bail case, or even if you are looking at the Supreme Court in its decision about the extradition to Sweden, they haven't taken this into account. And they it's not so that they understand that these duties are on all bodies of the state, including courts, and particularly, of course, in practice on courts of last instance. But of course, here in this extradition context, it is so obvious that this must be taken account of. And whatever happens at first instance, and frankly, what we've seen at first instance in this case have been, it's a pretty poor showing, you know, what the judges have allowed themselves to say during the hearings, the put downs, the characterizations. It's very unjudicial, and it has been a great surprise to me, who do not follow first instance court proceedings that often. It's been a great surprise to me. I've never seen anything like it. We'll hope these things will hopefully be clarified now before this next round of this extradition hearing, still at first instance. And we must just hope that the judge manages to control, himself or herself, so that you don't get that completely biased impression we've seen this far.
Thank you, Mats. Before we go into the more detailed questions, one more very, very basic question. And this is, sorry, Ben, not to direct a question yet at you, but just again for Mats. Could you explain why Julian's prior detention, both in the Ecuadorian embassy and elsewhere, has been classified with the term arbitrary, and how the Working Group on Arbitrary Detention thinks about what's arbitrary about this detention, please? Just for those of us who are new to the case, just for the first time, I'm trying to understand what's going on. And then I still have 8 to 10 questions from a number of much more complicated angles. That was for Mats.
Sorry, I lost that out. So I had some problems with the sound. Could you just repeat the conclusion?
Definitely can repeat the question. Thank you. I was saying, before we go into the more complicated questions that we're going to ask on non-refoulement, etc., Could I please ask you a very basic, maybe a two-line explanation of why Julian's detention in the Ecuadorian embassy, which some newspapers and media organizations
have
categorized like a holiday, is actually arbitrary?
Yes. So basically, the moment Assange had stepped into the street, he would have been apprehended. And the working group held that he could not be apprehended because they hadn't made out sufficient grounds for keeping him in detention. There was also this precedent and of putting him into this high security detention, which the working group held was in itself arbitrary. So the point then was, he was in this embassy, and the comparison was with house arrest. So you stay in your own home. Can that constitute detention? Yes, it can. The working group held that for political leaders. And then I mentioned the instance of something which wasn't a formal house arrest, but an actual house arrest with the wife of the Chinese Nobel Peace laureate, who then had no means of communication. And the moment she stepped into the street, she was then surrounded by agents of the state in suits, who then made her return to her home, her flat. So the point was then that there was a clear jurisprudence about house arrest and about similar forms of restrictions, which then could constitute detention as well. And so again, then, Assange is in the embassy. He's free to step into the street. He could absolutely do that anytime he wanted. As those who were there or read the newspaper stories, there was a constant police presence. He would have been apprehended. What would then happen to him? He would be put into prison. And in addition to that, he will be put into this high security regime, which in itself then constituted arbitrary detention. So therefore, there were no issue. There was no doubt in the working group about this on the basis of his own jurisprudence and that of other international bodies.
Thank you, Mats. That's very helpful. There are two related questions. These are from Alina and Stephanie on the chat, and I'm going to read these out because there are a number of our viewers who are on the wider live stream. So the question was, firstly, to thank the speakers for their input, but to say, is there universal jurisdiction or responsibility to protect when a state commits crimes against an individual rather than on a large scale? Also, can Julian Assange and his team go on the offensive and sue the UK government or judiciary now, and maybe even the legislative branches, given the infamous Julian Assange exception to the laws regarding European arrest warrants for arbitrary detention and psychological torture, which have put his life in danger and have greenlighted possible refoulement to the US? So that's the first part of the question. And the second part of the question, just for our viewers who can't see it, is Stephanie makes a point that the whole process seems to be being conducted in bad faith. And if, for example, given the current risks that Julian faces, given he has a chronic lung condition, which he's had since 2012, and we have COVID raging through prisons and detention facilities, the case, she says she doesn't know the legal term for it, but it seems a very frivolous way of eroding Julian's rights and everyone's time, and time that you cannot get back. And especially, you know, many of us are now aware that Stella Morris has come out and said Julian has two very young children. And as a parent myself, I can tell you the first few years are some of the most amazing and wonderful years. So Julian's missing out on all of these things, from not just his health is deteriorating and he's likely to die, but also in the little hope he has and the little people who give him hope, he's not having access to those. So could I ask all three of you if you would offer your thoughts on that, please, starting perhaps with Robert, and then actually starting with Ben, because Ben hasn't had a chance to
contribute. Actually, I don't think those questions are for me, because they're about whether there might be a cause of action in UK courts. They're about international law. So if there's a part of it where I can weigh in after the other speakers go, I will. But why don't you let them go?
Thank you. Robert Thibault, please.
I'll address the sort of the latter part of the questions, and that is, from what I've seen, what many observers have seen is the behavior of the magistrate appears to be unfair. They're
shocking, really. Huh?
Yes, it may amount to an appearance of bias. This is going to be an issue that's going to be decided by the higher courts in the UK. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Fitzgerald is doing a wonderful job advancing his client's case and, you know, pointing out the behavior of the magistrate, but also the behavior of the court security on how they're physically manhandling Mr. Assange in court. This is all shocking. But again, this is going to be an issue that's going to go to the higher courts. And depending on what the higher courts say at the end of the day, Mr. Assange may have other remedies under UK law and to sue the government at some point in time. But unfortunately, right now, Mr. Assange's legal team has to continue fighting through the extradition hearing and make sure they're prepared for the higher court appeal. And another point is whoever wins at this stage, I foresee that this is definitely going to go up to the higher courts. As Mad said, pointed out earlier, this is a case that will go to the Supreme Court at some point. And this is going to take many years. Related to that, I have two other concerns I want to mention. Relating to what Mad said is that Mr. Assange is at risk of being detained for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years. And there's one constitutional right which hasn't been mentioned anywhere yet, and that is also under Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights, and that's security of the person. And my view is that there may be a case to be argued in Assange's defense. From the time he was arrested by UK authorities in 2012, his arbitrary detention in the Ecuadorian embassy, and his treatment right now, there may be a case to argue that there's been a disproportionate infringement on his security rights, because you can see that he's being ground down. He's being ground down, pummeled down by the UK authorities and his treatment in the court. I'm shocked that the magistrate has not stepped forward to take control of his treatment, his adverse treatment within the court. And the judge, the magistrate has a right to do that.
And there is prior precedent for that, which Mr. Fitzgerald has argued in court. So thank you, Robert, for that. Mats, did you want to add some
things? I completely agree with what Robert said. It's obviously on the magistrate to do this, and that has been denied in several rounds in a way which looks very bad, you know, looks bad in the UK, and it looks very, very bad abroad. And then to stick to the broad, keep to the broad question, the international law, the working group already in 2015 said arbitrary detention and a right to compensation. So as a matter of international law, the United Kingdom has a duty to compensate Mr. Assange. And, the arbitrary detention prohibitions in the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 5, or in the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 9, have particular provisions about the right to compensation. They are the only human rights which have in their provision in these instruments a direct right to compensation. Now, how that will work in domestic court and how practical it is actually then to get the compensation is one matter. Another matter is that it has been established already at an international level that the UK authorities has this duty to compensate Mr. Assange.
On that point, Mats, there's a question for Robert Thibault, which is there a real chance of bringing the case before the European Court of Human Rights? And this is a question from Heike Hensel, asking what is the chance that this comes through to the European Court of Human Rights? And I wondered if Mats, between you and Robert, you can offer some thoughts on that.
Mats, I'll let you lead on this because
okay. Now, well, yes, obviously, it's within their purview. It is a highly political case. That's why the UN bodies have proved to be more effective, because the UK and the US, the UK has less influence Sweden and the UK have less influence. The UN bodies apply the law in a more independent way. This may surprise somebody, but people who follow these bodies will not be surprised. Is there a possibility of complaining over several of these stages? Yes. So typically now, then, when the case has gone to the Supreme Court, there is a right of complaint for Mr. Assange. What will that mean? Will it be effective? Many questions to that he has this right. Absolutely clearly, that is a violation of international law and European Convention on Human Rights. Yes, absolutely clearly, it has been established by all the international bodies already. So that's the best answer I can give.
Thanks, Mats. Could I also ask, one of the things that we've had discussions outside this group today, but people have asked, what is the impact of stuff like Brexit on the European Convention of Human Rights, which has actually been transposed into British law, I believe, and then also the ability to appeal to the European Court of Human Rights. Are there any implications now if Britain comes out of the EU in December, and what kind of back retrospective rights will Julian have? Would you be able to say a few words?
As of now, there's no limitations on his right to bring a complaint. The rules say he has to exhaust all domestic remedies. So it means basically when it has been in the human right in the Supreme Court. Of course, we have to hope and frankly expect the Supreme Court not to accept this extradition. There's such a clear legal case, so it should never come to that. If it should, which it won't, then there would be a possibility for him to bring this complaint, as I mentioned, and that would be unaffected by Brexit. And I don't think the UK would withdraw from the European Convention or change its Human Rights Act. And if it was going to do it, it is not going to happen straight away, and it wouldn't, I think, have any effect on Mr. Assange's claim.
I tend to agree with Mats. I'm not a UK qualified lawyer, but from what I've read, the UK hasn't amended the Human Rights Act. They haven't withdrawn from the European Convention of European Court of Human Rights or the Convention. But Boris Johnson has publicly stated recently that they intend to withdraw. But again, that will take some time. And I don't see the British government taking any active steps to withdraw at this stage. So hopefully that won't happen. And Mr. Assange will have a right to appeal to the European court if it comes to that. But I do agree, hopefully the Supreme Court in the UK will make the right decision. And quash any extradition order or affirm that there should not be an extradition order by the lower courts.
I think it's quite an interesting time to talk about this, because if we look back at the Stratfor leaks, having looked at them, it occurs to me that, you know, their statements that they were going to move him from country to country to make sure he eats cat food in prison, to treat him, to grind him down, to grind his family down, seems to be something that is already happening, and the plans of Stratfor have come into play. One of the things that a lot of people here are concerned about is, firstly, there are deep concerns about the behaviours of people like Paul Close at the CPS and others. And some of this has happened in the dark. You know, we only know about CPS's collusion with the Swedish prosecution through freedom of information requests. And Stefania Maurizi was on the last Free the Truth event, and she made the point that even with the information that has been provided, several bits of key information have been redacted, and there have been no reasonable grounds provided for those redactions. So one of the questions from the audience is, how can the case, which currently is not hugely well covered by the media, other than for sometimes repeating the smears or just giving some superficial analysis, because clearly, you know, you would expect that journalists would be interested in this case. And yet many don't seem to be offering it the level of expertise and insight that you would require. How can this case be moved to a larger court where justice can not just be done, but also be seen to be done, so that, you know, as somebody who's visited the course, last time I was there, it was only 5 people were allowed in the public gallery, and that was during Corona. And before Corona, there was once where we were 13 in the public gallery. So the press is not reporting on it. The public's not able to see justice being done. And we have people talking about open justice. So how can we ask for remedies that allow for this trial to take place in public? And what kind of remedies do we have within standard process without taking them to court?
I'd like to touch on
holding them accountable for misfeasance in public office. Sorry, Robert, please go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to touch upon the issue of open justice, because in Hong Kong, I've done a number of cases and made a number of applications, and open justice is a constitutional right under the Hong Kong Bill of Rights, the Basic Law, but also the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And the leading case precedents in Hong Kong are actually from the UK. And open justice, the crux of it is that the constitutional provisions are that the public has a right to go in and listen, but also to communicate, but to receive information. That attaches itself to the fundamental right of freedom of expression, where freedom of expression is not just not expressing oneself, but also the right to receive information. And Mr. Fitzgerald has raised this issue about open justice in these proceedings, from what I've read. Mm-hmm. And this is a significant concern. I think at the end of the day, this is going to be an issue that will be decided in the higher courts, because it goes to whether Mr. Assange fundamentally is receiving a fair hearing at this stage. In my view, he isn't. And the one thing that struck me was, I understand on the fourth day of the last set of hearings in February, last week, the adjournment application was made by Mr. Fitzgerald on Mr. Assange's behalf, and the magistrate was against it, but it was the U.S. government, as the client, as the prosecutors, that they indicated that an adjournment was probably the best way forward. So you can even see the U.S. lawyers realize that something is going awry in this case, and that I'm quite sure they're looking at what's happening and thinking, well, on appeal, any extradition order is going to be quashed, because yeah. Mr. Assange hasn't been provided the due process rights he's entitled to. And that includes having the case open to the public and full robust reporting.
And as you saw, there was very limited reporting of Monday's ruling, wasn't it? The way it appeared in the mainstream media, it came late and it was very low down on any page. Now, I think it's important to realize the power which is against Mr. Assange. So for each lawyer like Robert, you know, there's 100 or hundreds on the other side. Now we are of course relying on the press for good reason, but the majority of people in the press, the people who make decisions, they basically support the government and support the government's policies. And at least when you come to issues such as this, so fundamental in some people in power's view, the sympathy in the press will not necessarily mean anything. So first of all, it may not be for Mr. Assange, and their instincts may not be, but their instincts would probably be more to protect and defend the government. And of course, as Ben laid out, the US scene in Europe, it's much more split in on the press side. Leading editors and journalists, very few have been as clear as some of the Americans have have been. And just on this point, how do you approach it in many European contexts? And some Americans as well say that Mr. Assange is not a journalist. He is not involved in press activity. So therefore, he falls outside protection we should have as press or as journalists or editors. And the last point, I think, Dipa, you mentioned Stefania Merizzi, who then found out what seems to be a very problematic collusion between Swedish and UK police prosecutors, and she used Swedish access of information rules to get access to documents there. Very difficult for her, and very difficult to get access to information in on the UK side. What she found was surprising and shocking. It was disloyal, you know, for public officials to get involved in that kind of collusion from what we've seen. So again, you know, that's something which came up very recently, because she hired a Swedish lawyer who assisted her as a press, as an independent press person without any power of a big press organization behind her. And that is quite worrying, you know, that the resources, even at this stage, behind Mr. Assange, they are so limited compared to what you find on the other side. Well, distressing, perhaps not surprising. As I started off to say, there are some people in the state apparatus in the UK and in the US, in the US in particular, but in many other countries as well, who regard this as a vital state interest, a vital state interest to have Mr. Assange sent to the US and probably then in effect locked up for the rest of his life, however long that may be under those conditions.
Thank you, Matt. Could I just take, before we go on to the next round of questions, could I make some important announcements, please? There are some very interesting points that have come up today in relation to press and press freedom. I'd like to remind you of an event which is taking part as part of a virtual global march for international, for Global Press Freedom Day, for World Press Freedom Day. 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, I will be hosting an interview with a journalist who has had the courage to put together over 1,000 journalists for Journalists Speak Up for Assange, Serena Tinari. She's a Swiss journalist. She's going to start kick us off at 11 o'clock tomorrow with an interview, followed by a discussion from two very eminent academics who've been involved in scrutinizing the media, who've been involved in understanding propaganda, in understanding how narratives are shaped, Professor Des Friedman and Justin Schlossberg. And they will be talking at 11:30 via the Free the Truth banner tomorrow as part of World Press Freedom Day. In addition, later on in the day at about 2 o'clock, we will have Alison Mason talking to two very interesting independent journalists, young journalists, Tariq Haddad and Moel Mazi, and then later in the evening at about 4 p.m., Scott's Defend Assange will be having a conversation with Chris Williamson, John White, the journalist, and with Greg Hadfield, former journalist. So we have some charges are shared by the UK as per extradition rules. Would this not set a precedent that allows for extradition requests for publishing leaks from countries that the UK has other treaties with, not the US, but other treaty countries? And then she says, would there be enough legal uproar against the double standard by the UK for urging Iran to release Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, for example, but extraditing Julian? Surely our judiciary wants to be recorded in history for performing an incredible and quotable defense. What better opportunity than to fiercely defend journalists who test the integrity of a democracy? So, any thoughts on that, please?
So maybe I'll just start with what the charges are. I obviously will not comment on the parts of it that are about the UK judiciary in particular. But there's basically the charges against Assange were unveiled in two stages, as we heard before. The first charges that were disclosed to the public was just one charge under a US law called the Computer Fraud an abuse act. And this essentially alleges that Julian assisted Chelsea Manning in violating her own legal obligation not to access certain parts of U.S. military computers. So the core crime was committed by Chelsea Manning. She gained unauthorized access to certain parts of the U.S. military's computer system to which she did not have lawful access in her position. And Julian, by offering to help her crack a password, it is essentially shares the guilt for that offense. Now, that charge is both legally and factually weak. It's legally weak because it's not at all clear that Chelsea Manning actually violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, although the military court said she did. Most scholars believe that that charge would not hold up in a real U.S. federal court where Julian would be. And if Chelsea Manning didn't violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, Julian certainly cannot be guilty of conspiring to help her violate that law. It's factually weak because we know that at the time that Julian is alleged to have had a conversation with Chelsea Manning in which he allegedly offered to help her crack this password, she had already disclosed the bulk of information to WikiLeaks, so that this was a really factually irrelevant conversation that they had had. The reason why the U.S. led with that charge was precisely because they knew how controversial the Espionage Act charges, which are the ones that came next, would be, and how those would be viewed as an attack on journalism. And what in fact you saw was when this Computer Fraud and Abuse Act charge was revealed, there was huge celebration and relief in the U.S. legal and journalistic communities. People said, oh, this is terrific. They found a way to distinguish what Assange did here from what journalists do on an everyday basis, because journalists are not, you know, trying to help their sources hack computers or give them passwords. That's not journalism. So this is a really easy way to distinguish it. Someday I'd like to know what went on in the U.S. government, how it was that they started with this charge and then just a few weeks later came with a real case. And the real case was, you know, 17 more charges, which essentially were, as the questioner said, criminalizing investigative journalism, charging him with the offense of publishing the documents that Chelsea Manning was convicted of having provided to him. And this is where, again, it becomes extremely difficult. By the way, you don't have to believe that Julian Assange is a journalist or that WikiLeaks is a news organization to understand that these charges are a threat to press freedom, because the charges are about the conduct. U.S. law doesn't define journalist, and it shouldn't define journalist. We don't want to get into hair splitting about whether a blogger is a journalist or whether this person is or is not. The question is the activity a journalistic activity? Is this publishing? And we shouldn't spend time on the status or character of the person who's doing that kind of publishing, or even really necessarily their motivation. Because we don't want courts saying, you know, this person did this to help the country, this person did this to harm the country. The reason why the Espionage Act charges are such a threat to the New Yorker, to the Washington Post, to the New York Times, is that they allow the government to make it a crime to publish truthful information that was lawfully acquired. Right now, if the U.S. government had evidence, and I want to be very clear about this, if the U.S. government had information that Julian Assange or WikiLeaks had actively assisted in the hacking of U.S. government computers in order to obtain the information, that would be a chargeable offense. That would not be the same kind of threat to press freedom. There is no evidence that that has happened, not a shred of evidence that that has happened. If the government had that evidence, they would have put that forward. What he is charged with is publishing the information that was given to him by someone else's criminal activity. And that's why this case is such an enormous threat to freedom of the press.
Thank you, Ben. Robert and Mats, did you want to add anything? Mats, you're still on mute.
I agree with those points, but it has been a major argument in the European context that press people who do not want to support Mr. Assange's case, they say it doesn't affect us because he's not a journalist. And well, of course, it's a completely inappropriate argument, and I agree with all of your all Ben's arguments. The point is only that, of course, free speech discourse is not that sophisticated, and it's much more opportunistic in the way it's used by some press people in the European context, but also this idea of what was behind, you know, the way we had in Europe a discussion around the first set of charges, that there were so many who said that before the violation of the Espionage Act indictment came out, that the idea that it was the Computer Fraud Abuse Act indictments, that that was the whole case, that was the true case. There were a number of very respectable mainstream journalists and media who were very tough on that in the UK and in Europe otherwise, and who came up with a very strong defense of the actions by the US government on that ground, not recognizing, of course, as you said, Ben, the real reason behind came out shortly afterwards. And you had a series of issues, you know, when you were extradited on certain grounds, what limitations do you then follow of the extradition, and to what extent would those limitations be enforceable as a limiting factor on the prosecution later on in the US? Useless discussion, absolutely not any purpose at all, except perhaps legitimating an extradition on the grounds which were up then.
Thank you, Max. So, in terms of this case, I think we have a few more questions to answer, but we're getting very close to time. So I wanted to highlight a few things for those of you who are interested in the legal aspects of the case. Over 40 international jurists have signed a letter, including Robert Thibault and others have signed a letter condemning the way in which Julian has been treated, pointing to the issues including the extraterritorial reach of the US state, the breach of legal privilege, you know, and just to whet your appetite, we are going to have a future event, which is scheduled in the next few weeks, which I will announce through Twitter and through other social media, on the Spanish case and how Julian's rights were breached so egregiously. There are also issues that many of us will be considering in relation to the way the CPS colluded with the Swedish prosecution in order to prolong what was a case where charges were never even brought. And there is a great danger there, both on the Swedish side in terms of the way in which not just due process rights were undermined, but the mechanism of the state was hijacked to essentially abuse and torture and persecute one individual.
Yes.
And this is something that many of us will be deeply concerned about. We are also deeply concerned about how the British CPS has been so, not just so badly behaved in colluding with the US state, with the US and others, to delay the Swedish prosecution, prevent the Swedish prosecutors from coming over to interview Julian, to giving them advice on how to cover up things for the media in some ways, and most importantly, in subverting a lot of the basic procedural things that we expect the Crown Prosecution Service to be able to do here. Lastly, I also want to highlight to you that we will be having an event. Many of us have heard, and those of you who came in early to this call and those of you immediately after this call, that we are showing a video, a it's only about 6 minutes from our first Free the Tooth event, which where Niels Meltzer explains psychological torture. And we are also going to have an event soon with psychologists and experts talking about why Julian's case is about psychological torture, why it's not just about and why he needs to be released on bail urgently. I'd urge you to write to your MP. The DEA website has information on what you can put in it. Julian is a vulnerable prisoner. He's at great risk from COVID because of his lung condition and because of the effects that torture has had on his body and on his mental health. Lisa Johnson, a very experienced and well-regarded psychologist, says, you know, when people talk about Julian's mental health, it's like grabbing a hammer and hitting somebody, 500 times, and then you find that they are hurt, and you say, oh yeah, the person's has a physical injury. No, the person's been beaten up. Versus, you know, if Julian has mental health issues now, it's a result of ongoing and prolonged psychological torture. So we'll be covering all these issues in the next few weeks or months as we proceed to the trial, and we hope that the judge will treat Julian fairly in the weeks that come. I'd like to now pause here and thank our speakers for their contributions and for their time today. Thank you to those of you who woke up very early to join us. Thank you to all our guests. We've been very grateful for your questions. I've not been able to put all the questions to the speakers, but we will try to have future events where these questions will also be answered. And thank you very much for participating. Thank you, Ian, for helping organize this event. And thank you to Don't Extradite Assange and their technological support team, who've been very, very helpful in putting this event together. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
I'm Niels Meltzer. I am the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture. I have visited Julian Assange on the 9th of May 2019 in Belmarsh Prison. I have evaluated his situation and his case, and I am absolutely convinced that if extradited to the United States, he will be exposed to cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment or even torture. I am convinced that the conditions of detention he will be exposed to there and the unfair trial he will be exposed to are incompatible with human rights law and do not allow his extradition to the United States.
Julian Assange's case sets a precedent in relation to the extraterritorial reach of the US state to persecute a journalist and publisher with 100% track record of accuracy, who was carrying out journalism outside the US, in Europe, and who is an Australian citizen.
On 12th of December, there will be an election of a new government in Britain. There has been no mention during the campaign of the journalist and publisher in Belmarsh Prison, who is Britain's political prisoner. Julian Assange is not being punished for anything he has done wrong. He is being punished for everything he has done right.
The US is asserting the right to prosecute a non-US person who's not in the US under US laws. That is absolutely terrifying. Can you imagine if Russia wanted to prosecute an NGO or a journalist in London for revealing Russian crimes? It's exactly the same principle.
The extradition treaty between Britain and the United States includes one vital section that says, and I paraphrase it, no one shall be extradited if the offence which he or she is said to have committed is in any way political. 17 charges concocted against Julian Assange by the United States are based on the 1917 Espionage Act, which was and remains a political law enacted to chase after conscientious objectors during the First World War. What he attempted to do was smash through the wall which has been created between us and the actions of governments who are supposedly acting in our names. Now, the function of this is to scare people away from crashing through those walls.
Julian Assange was transferred to the healthcare division of Belmarsh, I believe about a week after my visit, and has been held there since then. His health seems to have entered a downward spiral now, and I'm seriously concerned for his life.
Psychological torture is not torture light. Psychological torture aims directly at destroying a person's personality and identity, of destabilizing a person mentally and emotionally to make them break.
Chronic psychological stress, trauma and torture doesn't only harm a person emotionally and cognitively, it also harms them physically. Being in that chronically elevated state of stress, so chronically activated stress physiology, so it's a very serious and dangerous situation. And there's a fundamental fact here that you can't adequately medically treat a torture victim while continuing to torture them.
The British government has out of hand dismissed the concerns of the United Nations. Not just the concerns of Nils Melzer, but dismissed the report of the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. And in hundreds of other cases, literally hundreds of other cases, every single one, the British government had always supported the decisions of that working group.
Now, Chelsea Manning is also re-imprisoned. She used WikiLeaks to expose the extensive cover-up of rape and other sexual violence and murder, including of women and children, by the US military in Afghanistan, Bosnia and Iraq. Do these victims not count? We have to save the lives of Chelsea and Julian, because in saving their lives, we're saving our own. Sending someone to their death or 175 years in prison and torture in the US for espionage has nothing to do with justice.
There are many reasons to defend Julian, even if you have never met him. Freedom of expression, rule of law, due process, democracy, sovereignty, the right to asylum, and human rights in general.
So what I say to all of you is continue the work of Julian Assange. Break their digital walls. Make that information the property of the public. We have the right to see it, and we must continue to penetrate their invisible walls of secrecy.
I know Julian very well. He's my friend. And I have no doubt that he deserves to be protected. Thank you.
It is not only that he is the victim of torture, it is not only that his life is at stake, it is not only we want to save him from a dreadful injustice, we also want to save him because the world needs Julian Assange as a symbol and fighter for liberty in these times.
The situation that Julian Assange finds himself in now has been created by predominantly by four states. The United States, predominantly, that wanted to achieve his extradition from the beginning, the United Kingdom, Sweden, and Ecuador. Currently, obviously, Julian Assange is in the jurisdiction of the UK. So it is the legal responsibility of the UK to ensure his human rights and to protect his human rights. This is not being done.
Meeting. Thank you very much. And thanks again to our speakers.